You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with George David Clark. George, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
George, this is the second time we talked. The first time we talked, we discussed your poetry and you read from your poetry. And in this talk, our second conversation, I wanted to talk about your editorial point of view and specifically 32 poems. So, and I know you're going to read from issues of 32 poems of other authors, but let's begin by talking about what is 32 poems and how did it begin and what's your relationship to that?
Sure. The journal has been around for about 18 years now. It began, John Poach and Deborah Ager and Bill Beverly, I believe they were all students, graduate students at University of Florida at the time, and they felt like there were things that were being missed. They were looking for a magazine that didn't exist yet. Some of their favorite poems they felt like weren't getting published. So they set out to make the journal that they wish existed in the world. About the same time, there is a fiction magazine called One Story, you might be familiar with, was sort of starting at the same time, and 32 Poems sort of saw itself as the poetry counterpart to this smaller magazine that would be a size that someone could actually sit down and read the entire thing rather than just finding the names that they knew and looking for old favorites. Hopefully it's a size that people will actually read the whole magazine. So there's 32 poems in every issue, and as a rule, they're shorter poems that fit on a single page. But we break that rule when we find something that we absolutely love that goes a little bit longer. But we're never going to be a place for sprawling 10-page poems, or it's even something in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 pages is going to be too much for us. So as a rule, they're these shorter poems. The magazine, like I said, has been around for about 18 years now, and I've been editing it for the last 8. So those three names I mentioned earlier, John Poach and Deborah Ager and Bill Beverly, John was selecting most of the poems that were appearing in the magazine. And at the time that I became involved, he was teaching at Texas Tech University, and I was one of his doctoral students. I'd been working with other literary magazines before that, the Virginia Quarterly Review in Charlottesville and Meridian. And before that, I'd been interested in literary editing even when I was an undergraduate and worked with a magazine called The Torch in Western Tennessee. So I was interested in literary magazines and started helping John out with what he was doing with 32 poems. And this would have been maybe 2008, 2009, somewhere in there. And he kept giving me more responsibility. And about 2011, he wanted more time to spend reading T.S. Eliot and Dante and his favorite works of literature that he felt were kind of getting pushed to the side by his responsibilities editing a literary magazine. So he was looking for some fresh blood to take over, and Deborah Ager, who had been the managing editor for both of them had been working on the project for a decade at that point. They were both looking to step down, and he asked me if I would replace him. So with the board's support, I took on that role in 2011.
And I know you're going to read and talk about some of these works, but to talk about the editorial process, how does that happen? How do the poems come to you and the people that you work with? And how do you select them, if I can ask that general question?
Yeah, cut me off if I go for too long answering that, because it's a pretty complicated question, and I think I could answer it in a number of different ways. The process as it stands now is that we use a software called Submittable, where people upload their their poems online. And we also accept work through the mail. So poems come to us digitally, and they also come to us by post. Everything that comes to us by post, I read and respond to myself. But we get somewhere around 25 submissions a day online. Most of what we receive comes to us that way. So we're reading several thousand poems a week, and that are submitted to us through Submittable.
That's a really impressive figure. So who is we? How many are on this team that are reading these and winnowing them down to possibilities?
Yes, there are eight of us that are reading. I glance at everything first when it first comes in. So every night I've got some time that I set aside to do that reading, just to go over what we received on a given day. And many things I know immediately are not for us. So some things it's clear, you know, if the poems are all five pages long, we need to send that to one of the associate editors. I can go ahead and put that in the pile of work that was sent to us in error. So I screen some things immediately that are clearly not a match. But most everything goes on to the associate editors next. So there's myself and seven other readers are looking at these poems pretty much all the time. And I send them groups of 10 poems in a batch, 10 submissions in a batch. That's probably 50 poems. And they'll read through them and send them back to me with their thumbs up or thumbs down. And then we go from there. Often one person likes it, somebody else will give it a look. And if two people like it, then we'll start a conversation about the poem. Sometimes that means that I'm calling and talking to the associate editors on the phone, and we're suggesting they're talking about what they loved about the poem that they're responding to, and they're sort of persuading me that it's one we need. Or we might be talking about potential edits. Do we have any suggestions for the poet, things that we might like to see revised or addressed if we accept the work? So we have that conversation for a while, and ultimately either myself or the other editor who's been really passionate about the piece will contact the poet in question and ask if the work is still available, if they will, if they'll let us publish it.
And when looking at poems, maybe the second layer, when really going through and deciding which one to choose, is there any kind of editorial policy? Are you looking for, is it really all about craft, or is there a certain content that you're also looking for? I know there's, of course, the length, but is there a content or a perspective that you're looking for?
Yeah, I think there is, but we define it really broadly, and we're always looking for things that feel like a 32 poems poem that we haven't published before. So something that's going to stretch us in a different way. But there are some consistent aesthetic preferences that I think show up in the magazine. We say that we're looking for poems that appeal to the ear, the eye, and the ego. And by that we mean poems that have a really interesting sense of sound, that are doing something rich with the sonic pleasures of our language. We're also looking for poems that are imagistically rich, that engage our other senses. And then when we say that we're looking for a poem that appeals to the ego, what we really mean is that we're looking for some real sentiment. We want a poem that's where the speaker has something at risk in the language that they're committing to the page. So something that's going to arouse our feeling and its content also. So that's a pretty broad definition of what we're looking for. But it gives us some guiding principles that are shaping our selections too. One of the things that maybe jumps out, go ahead.
No, I like that. No, go on. One of the things that jumps out as well.
Yeah, one of the things that jumps out at me very quickly when I'm reading submissions is a poet with a real sense of rhythm. And I don't mean necessarily meter, that highly structured, regularly recurring rhythm, but a poet that's thought about the way that these words are combined to string a musical phrase across the lines. That jumps out pretty quickly, and I think that's probably something that's fairly consistent across our selections.
And you're going to read, I know, a few poems today, and I'm glad we talked about how you select them first, and specifically what you just said, because I imagine these poems will be examples of that to some degree. So you're going to read, and maybe I should say, how did you select these today? You knew we were talking, we were going to discuss this, so you went through 32 poems and look for what, your favorites or one that best represented the publication?
Yeah, I think some of that. I picked up a couple of our recent issues, so I've just got the last two issues in my hand here. And I thought, which ones might work well with my voice and over the radio as opposed to being able to look at them on the page? So it's a poem that's going to show off maybe some verbal gymnastics, but isn't going to be so complicated that you really need to sit down and meditate on it line by line. But I'm really looking for poems that are just pleasurable to hear aloud, I guess.
So let's hear the first one. Which is the first one you're going to read?
All right, this is a poem by Catherine Pierce, and the title is Entreaty. Dear spring, commit. Burst your bee and bloom, your blaze of blue. Get heady, get frocked, get spun. Enough with your tentative little breaths, your one-day daffodils, one-day dew frost. Honeysuckle us right to our knees. Wake us with your all-night mockingbirds, your rowdy tree frogs. Gust and dust us. Pollen bomb the Hondas and front halls. But please, no more of this considering, this delicate tendriling. Your pale green worries me, your barely tuliped branches, your slim shoots any sideways look could doom. The truth is, I don't want to think about fragility anymore. I can't handle a blown glass season. Every grass blade and dogwood so wreckable. I'm trying hard to teach the infallibility of nightlights, to ignore the revving of my own fallible heart. Spring, you're not helping. Go all in. Throw your white blossoms into my gutters. Flood my garage. Mud my suede shoes. Leave me afternoon streaked and sweating. Vine yourself around me. Hold me to you. Tighter.
Thank you. I love that one. It really makes me smile, and it's kind of very, very sexy poem, right? Very sensual, honeysuckle us, and also very, I think it does kind of speak to some of the things that you were talking about in terms of rhythm, right? There's a beautiful, beautiful pulsing sense to that poem.
Yeah, it's certainly not a metrical poem, but it's one that you can almost sing to yourself as you're reading it.
Well, and it's incredibly visual too, pollen bombing is a kind of wonderful phrase, and you can see that covering cars and other things. It's very, very exciting to hear. Was that the first poem she's published with you, or do you tend to?
It is. Yeah, this is the first time that we've published Catherine Pierce. And that was just in the latest issue that came out this summer.
So let's hear another one. I'd love to hear another poem.
All right. This is a poet that we've published several times before. We have a policy that we won't publish someone within a year and a half of previous publications, so there's always a couple of issues before we publish someone again. But Amit Majmudar is someone we've had in the magazine quite a few times, and we're big fans of his work. This poem is called Detachment. They had their hack for suffering, the old yogis. Even a 2-inch levitation changes the lay of shadows. Better than the bow tree's shade is in the bow tree's branches, your monkey mind undressing a banana while Dobermans bark up at you in vain. Detachment gets you high above all pain. You're parasailing miles above a lake of fire, sawing, sobbing through the cable until you gust free in a falling, flying quest for a further shore. Detachment puts you in low Earth orbit, lens against the porthole to photograph your suffering down there, that Ganges with the lights along it, holy cities feeding off it like electric mosquitoes plugged in the mother aorta. The illness, the love, the illumination vault back into the flow. You see them brighten all your suffering from source to delta until its fault line, fate line blazes white to match the zigzag of the clear sky's lightning that struck you years ago. First grief, first gift. Keep going, higher. Gravity and you uncouple. Atoms start to break their bonds like oxygens with hydrogen. Those tears you're crying aren't water anymore. The synapse where your pain was crossing widens. Your neurotransmitters are spilling free and sprinkling space, which doesn't feel a thing. Neither do you, because you have dissolved at one with everything at last. Nirvana.
Thank you. And a really lovely poem, and of course, very different from the first one. This one feels, and perhaps we can speak about why this poet is such a favorite, an editorial favorite. But it's very heady in a way. You know, it gets almost, of course, existential about our sense of being and who we are. So it's this. For lack of a better word, think piece too, right? It's sensual. You're wrapped in it, but it's also somehow reflective or teaching, I guess I would say. What do you think about that? It's always hard for me to say, you know, react quickly to why a poem is effective or not. But that's my first feeling from it: is that wow, you know, something to sit back on and think about. As opposed to the first one, which was, you know, just like washing over me, and was a beautiful poem to be embraced by or to embrace. This one feels more like I have questions, or generates questions, or something like that.
Yeah, the Catherine Pierce poem that we read has a very particular attitude, and it's. Reiterates that attitude a number of times in this very florid, playful language. The Majmudar poem, I think you put it very well. I mean, it's more philosophical. It takes a metaphor and spreads that metaphor out. It keeps adding layers to it. So first, detachment is represented by the speaker up in a tree above their pain. Then they're in low Earth orbit. Then they're, you know, it's out in space somewhere where their molecules are separating. But it keeps extending on that metaphor as it thinks through the implications of being disconnected from the things that hurt us and bring us grief. I'm interested in the metaphor and the ways that Majmudar keeps complicating it. But this is another poem where I think sound is a big part of my pleasure, too. The rhythm there is, I'd say, quite a bit more regular than in the Catherine Pierce poem. There's lots of internal rhymes. And I think this is something that I kind of associate with an Amit Majumdar poem, is some really intensely crafted language that's playing with rhyme and rhythm in ways that constantly surprise me. Did that answer the question, or did I go off on a tangent?
No, that's it. That's interesting, and it's fine to go off on a tangent, but you didn't. That's clear. So let's hear, and you have another one. What's the next poem you're going to read?
All right, the last one I'll read is maybe another side of the magazine. It's hard to find a good narrative poem that fits inside the space of a page. So most of what we publish are lyrics, but we are constantly keeping our eyes open for other types of things. I thought maybe I'd share a more narrative piece. This is one
okay,
by...
Before you say that, before you read it, you said something, mostly what we publish is lyrics. And, of course, you don't mean lyrics to songs. You mean lyrical poetry as opposed to narrative?
Right. A lyric poem is one that, if narrative is that impulse where one thing causes another thing to happen and we move forward in time through this chain of cause and effect, I think of the lyric poem as one that sort of pauses time and meditates on it in an instant. It observes some object from a number of different angles, but the cause and effect is one thought triggers another thought rather than one thing happens and then another thing happens. Does that make sense? The lyric poems tend to pause time. But this is one where we've got two characters interacting, and there's a bit of a dialogue between them. And things do happen in time. So this is a poem by Michael Bazett called The Miracle. I set out the bottle of Chateauneuf de Pape, the hunk of Manchego, crusty bread, a little dish of olive oil with crushed black pepper, then pour the wine with that lovely fluting sound lilting out toward the armchair where he sits. I settle in across from him, holding my glass to my nose, inhale and say, "Maybe one of your best ideas ever, my friend." He smiles. Some things just happen. Like grape juice going bad. It's just trying to get back to the earth it came from. He hovers one hand above his glass, and the color falls away as easily as a silk scarf dropping to the floor. Nothing but clear water. He lifts the glass. It's from the well on your grandparents' farm, laced with the taste of that tin cup they kept by the spigot, remember? And I do. It holds the mossy green taste of my childhood. We fall silent. The wine is good. I can even taste the hints of leather mentioned on the little card at the store, where it was proclaimed earthy, brooding, and a little fierce. But I mostly just want to drink from that well. How long have you been turning wine into water, I ask, striving for an airy tone that ends up sounding peeved? Isn't the opposite more your thing? If you recall, that was actually a favor for my mom, he shrugs. I guess you could say that was more of a young man's miracle. He keeps talking, but I'm not even paying attention anymore. Because outside the meadow has grown thick with butterflies, and the air is littered with wings.
Thank you, George. Yeah, that was a beautiful one, and a great selection, right? Those are all so different. Now, to talk about that one a little bit, we were talking about narrative versus lyrical.
As narrative goes, it's a pretty short narrative.
Right.
Just a couple back and forths and of dialogue between those two characters. Yeah.
And and beautiful. I mean, very different than the other two, right? The other two, just in terms of content, you know, and just the way it begins, you know, one of your best ideas and this kind of almost cliche scene of, you know, the wine, the manchego, the cheese, the artist talking, but then getting into kind of, you know, beautiful, to me, subtleties of relationships and time and, you know, immediately brought to me these kind of tastes and everything, but brought me back to several very specific memories I had of things that I associate with scenes like that of being in a farm or drinking certain kinds of water even.
Yeah, it's such an interesting idea that we've got the, you know, where the first two poems I read, they both take place entirely in the poet speaker's mind, right? There's this poem, as you were saying, it's set in a room between, you've got two characters, one of which it sounds like is Jesus Christ, and the poet is serving him a glass of wine, and instead of drinking it, he transforms the wine into water. But not just any water, it's water that has this rich sentimental connotation for the poet. And they talk a little bit about maybe where our pleasure and a taste comes from. I think, were you saying that it brought to mind experiences from your own childhood or your past?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it does the same for me too, that, you know, it's one thing to drink Chateauneuf du Pape, but are there other tastes that actually mean more to me? I mean, one is that, you know, that's the thing people pay so much for, but there are other tastes that I'd probably be willing to sacrifice more myself for that sentimental experience.
Yeah, I agree. You know what, can I ask you to read that poem once more before we end?
Sure.
Because now I think there's other things that I would catch in there. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to hear that again.
Yeah, let me see if I can find it real quick. I shut the book.
Because it's always interesting to talk about them, and then, you know, and then there's some things, you know, maybe that wine might have been missed, the turning water into wine.
Sure.
It's kind of always been a fascination of mine. I didn't quite catch, and would love to hear that.
All right. This is Michael Bazett, The Miracle. I set out the bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape, the hunk of manchego, crusty bread, a little dish of olive oil with crushed black pepper, then pour the wine with that lovely fluting sound lilting out toward the armchair where he sits. I settle in across from him, hold my glass to my nose, inhale, and say, "Maybe one of your best ideas ever, my friend." He smiles. Some things just happen, like grape juice going bad. It's just trying to get back to the earth it came from. He hovers one hand above his glass, and the color falls away as easily as a silk scarf dropping to the floor. Nothing but clear water. He lifts the glass. It's from the well on your parents' farm, laced with the taste of that tin cup they kept by the spigot. Remember? And I do. It holds the mossy green taste of my childhood. We fall silent. The wine is good. I can even taste the hints of leather mentioned on the little card at the store where it was proclaimed earthy, brooding, and a little fierce. But I mostly just want to drink from that well. How long have you been turning wine into water? I ask, striving for an airy tone that ends up sounding peeved. Isn't the opposite more your thing? If you recall, that was actually a favor for my mom, he shrugs. I guess you could say that was more of a young man's miracle. He keeps talking, but I'm not even paying attention anymore, because outside the meadow is grown thick with butterflies, and the air is littered with wings.
Thank you. Reading that again. Yeah, that's kind of, that's fascinating. And now, you know, different things strike me, but the idea of right, turning wine into water or water into wine is, of course, two very different things. And I love the idea of it being kind of looked at as a young man's miracle, because it always struck me as one of the, of all miracles that there are that I know of, the idea of, you know, a wedding party is completely drunk already on tons of wine, and a miracle is created so that they can keep drinking and partying another two days or whatever it was, seems like really bizarre, but also somehow authentic, because it's not a healing or something. It's kind of like this guy is a party animal, you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, I can remember very clearly the moment when I knew I wanted to publish that poem was when I got to that line. And I'd been enjoying the poem even up to there, but that line about it's really more of a young man's miracle, I thought was so charming and incisive and interesting in such a great way. I knew I wanted that poem immediately.
Yeah, I remember talking to a poet quite a while ago. It was actually Daniel Berrigan, and I was looking at his poems, and there was one where, I don't know, there was a line in it, you know, kind of, this is my blood, this is my writing, this is, you know, my something like that. I'm paraphrasing it terribly. When I was with him looking at that, he said, ah, that's a young man's poem.
Yeah.
And something wonderful about that idea. So George, it's been great talking to you. I want to ask, of course, you one more question about what you're reading, but also there will be links in here so people can subscribe or get copies of this. Is it possible to subscribe to this?
It is, yep. We take subscriptions through the mail and through our website. There's a place you can subscribe there, or you can order individual issues.
Okay. And so the links will be there for listeners to subscribe. And the last question is, what are you reading now, George?
You know, I've been on a Franz Reich kick the last couple of weeks, and the last couple of weeks I've been reading mostly Franz Reich. Lately, Walking to Martha's Vineyard it's been a favorite of mine for many years, but it's been a pleasure to go back into his work these last few weeks.
George, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was great to chat.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.